they went to look at the cars, and they were looking around, and they realized that none of them were red. Wait a minute, we're going to open a Ferrari dealership, and we're going to have no red Ferraris? They sold all those cars in less than a couple months. In the early 70s, a few years before Brian opened the dealership, Ferrari hadn't even sold 100 cars in America. I've always felt the businesses that really succeed are the ones that did something different.
That was Jim Ciardella, author of The Dealer, How One California Dealership Fueled the Rise of Ferrari Cars in America. Today we discuss the fascinating story of what was the most successful Ferrari dealership in the country with Jim. This is Fuel for the Future, presented by State Farm Insurance and driven by America's Automotive Trust. I'm Michael May. Jim, welcome. Do you mind giving us a short synopsis of the book?
Sure. The Dealer really tells a 20-year story of the dealership in Northern California that was called Ferrari of Los Gatos. It started in 1976, and it ran through 1995 under the ownership of Brian Burnett. And it really highlights how it was Brian had a partner, so it was a couple 30-year-olds built a business, a Ferrari dealership that actually became the largest Ferrari dealership in the United States, maybe even in the whole world, over that 20-year period. It's kind of the rise and fall of the dealership.
You focus on Brian Burnett a lot in your book, who's one of the partners that you mentioned, and this is because you know Brian. I'd love to know how you met him and why you wanted to take his stories and actually turn that into a novel.
Sure. So it's interesting. I moved to Los Gatos. It's now probably almost 20 years ago. I'm not there anymore, but I was there for, 6 or 8 years. And I came into a restaurant there, a popular restaurant in downtown Los Gatos, Forbes Mill Steakhouse, one night. And a friend of mine was sitting at the bar, and he had a seat next to him. I went and sat down to have dinner with him, and he said, "Hey, Jim, I'd like to introduce you to my friend, Brian Burnett." And so I reached across and I shook hands with him. And the next thing my friend Bill said to me is, "Brian used to own the Ferrari dealership here in town." And, you know, my jaw dropped and I was like, "Whoa, really? Oh, my gosh." I was at that dealership when I was probably in my 20s and drooling at all the cool cars. And, you know, I've always had a dream that I wanted to own a Ferrari. And the next words out of Brian's mouth were, "Do you still want one?" And, so he was in sales mode. I could tell he's always in sales mode, and probably why he was so successful. But I said, "Sure, I do." So he picked up his cell phone. I heard him say, "Do you still have the 308? Of course, I couldn't hear what was on the other side of the line. And then I just heard him say, "Don't do anything with it. It's sold." And he hung up.
Oh, wow.
And then he turned to me and he told me a little bit about the car. It was pretty much the car I had, the Ferrari I had been dreaming about. Ever since growing up, I watched Magnum PI driving a 308 Ferrari around Hawaii and kind of fell in love with that model. And that's what this was. And so I said, "Yeah, I want the car." And so Brian said to me, "Okay, you need to write a check for $10,000. Well, I never travel with my checkbook normally, but for some reason that night I had my checkbook with me. It was out in my briefcase in the car. And I said, "Okay." And I got up from the bar stool and I started walking towards the front door. I got about halfway to the front door and I heard somebody yelling, "Jim, Jim." I turned around and it was Brian waving me back to the seat. And I came back and I sat down he said, "It was just a test." He said, "You don't know how many people have told me they want to buy cars and then flaked on me. And I just wanted to make sure you were serious." And I said, "Right. I'm serious. I'll tell you, I'll take the car." And he said, "Well, let me give you another lesson about buying cars." He said, "You never buy a car unless you or somebody you trust has seen the car. So let's go this weekend. We'll go Saturday. The car's in the shop. We'll go over and take a look at it. If you still want it, we'll buy it." So that was the way I met Brian. I bought the car. I still have it today. I love it. It's not one of the, you know, rare Ferraris that are worth millions of dollars, but it's a Ferrari that was my dream car, and it works for me. So, that's how I met him. We became friends. It ended up, we didn't know each other before that night, but we lived on the same street in Los Gatos, probably 3 or 4 blocks away from each other. And, he and I ended up becoming friends and having dinner together, like I say, 2 or 3 nights a week, or maybe on the weekends. And, he always told me stories. He would tell me one story after another, and they were all pretty amazing stories. And he finished every single story with, "Somebody ought to write a book about this, I'm telling you." And I probably listened to him say that for at least a year, maybe even longer. I don't know. It could have been 2 years. And so finally one night I said to him, "Brian, I'll do it. I'll write the book." And he looked at me and he said, "Well, how can you write the book? You're an accountant. You know, I spent all my life in high-tech companies in Silicon Valley, you know, as a finance guy." And so, yeah, I had never written a book before. This was my first book. But I said, "Brian, I'll figure it out. If we've got a will to do this, we'll make it happen." And so, yeah, that's how I met him. Got to know him, and just one night, I don't know if I was sick and tired of hearing him saying, "Somebody ought to write a book about it." I'll do it. It was a challenge for me, but it was something I always wanted to do. I think of myself, if you saw my business card, it says storyteller and author. So I've always felt that I've always enjoyed telling stories. My friends have always said, "Oh, it's great to have Jim at a party because he's always got so many stories to tell." So this was just another way of me being able to tell my story instead of with my mouth, with my hand. So.
Right. Well, you did a great job. The book is fascinating. Brian is a character, and you know, you sometimes come across people saying someone should write a book about it. And this is actually true. Someone should have written a book, and you did. And you know, when I first heard about it, I thought, okay, it's a book about a dealership. It's a Ferrari dealership. So that's interesting in and of itself, but like really what could be in it? And I was fascinated and I got really, wrapped up in it. So you did a fantastic job, and I'm sure we'll get into a few of the stories a bit later on as we're talking.
Absolutely.
But I am interested to know, you grew up in Palo Alto. Do you remember the first time you heard about Ferrari of Los Gatos?
Yeah, I probably heard about it when I was younger, but I was never really a car guy, quote unquote. I had a younger brother that, my brother Ron, he's definitely a car guy, and he's turned into a car guy to this day, collects cars and involved in a lot of different car clubs. And, I remember him telling me about the dealership. He may have been the first person that told me about it. And, you know, but he's 10 years younger than me. So I was probably away at college when he was, you know, telling me about it. And that's why I say when I came back from college was really the first time I went to the dealership. I was in my early 20s probably. And, I saw, all the great cars there. And so I went 2 or 3 times to visit. I don't ever remember meeting Brian. I don't know if I did or not. You know, he may have been back in his office and I talked with the salesman when I was there. But yeah, that's really how I heard about it. And then over time, though, everybody in Silicon Valley would talk about it, you know, especially in the 1980s when a lot of the high-tech computer companies were going public and the CEOs and other executives would go and buy a Ferrari after they went public. That was everybody knew about it.
Right. And that was the place to go. And as you have already said, this is probably the biggest Ferrari dealership, perhaps in the entire world, definitely in the country the time. And Brian seems to have a real knack for selling cars and a love and a passion to do it. And one of the stories that kind of stood out to me in the book is that he became a sales manager at a different dealership when he was only 29 years old, because some people were trying to get a piece of his commission, some other salespeople. And I just love that story of him taking that straight to the boss, essentially, and being like, hey, do you know this is happening? And not being afraid to do that, not worried about what the repercussions may be, to kind of say it. And he just got put in place as sales manager. And do you think that that's a reflective story on sort of Brian's passion and skill at selling cars, because he was able to do that so quickly at such a young age?
Yeah, he's got a personality, and I'm sure it's, you know, his heritage, his family. But he's got a personality of just saying it the way it is, and you know, he doesn't mix words, and he just says what he's thinking. And he does have a lot of confidence, but the confidence is it's not just ego. He was, as a very young boy, his dad was a cutaway artist. That was Rex Burnett. And cutaway art is where they kind of show the car from the inside out. And in the early days, Brian's dad started doing cutaway artwork for Hot Rod Magazine. And he actually was in the inaugural issue of Hot Rod Magazine in 1948, October of 1948, when the first issue came out. He had a car in there that it was, you know, this was way before computers and CAD software and everything else. And but if you look at his drawings, which there is a picture of him drawing in the book, but they almost look like they were computer generated. And so Brian grew up around that. Brian's dad taught him everything about cars when he was very young. In fact, he told me that a story that when he was 4 years old and there were family gatherings, his uncles and other members of the family were always trying to stump him. They would tell him a little bit about a car or show him a picture of a bumper or something like that and say, what car is it, Brian? And he was only 4 years, 4 or 5 years old, and he could usually guess what car it was. So he grew up around that. His dad took him to car races when he was very young. I think there's a story in the book about him really seeing a Ferrari for the first time when he was about 10. And Jim Kimberly was in a Sports Car Club of America race. I think it was 1954, if I remember correctly. And he heard that V12 fire up, and he said, that sound has never left me. You know, he's quite a bit older today, obviously. And he said, I can still hear it like it just happened yesterday. You know, it's still in my head. So I think that's when he fell in love with Ferraris. He had a passion for cars always, but he really fell in love with Ferraris. And he claims that from that day forward, he read everything he could about Ferraris and said, someday, somehow I want to be involved with Ferraris. I don't know if at that age he knew he was going to become a dealer, but he loved the car and really wanted to be involved with it. So.
Yeah, we talk a lot about passion on this show. It keeps coming up. And, you know, he definitely has a huge passion for cars and all sorts of different aspects of it. And I think that's one of the reasons why he was so successful at this dealership. And the dealership came about, it's really, obviously, you wrote a book about it, so it's an interesting thing, and we don't want to give too much away. But dealerships, it's a tricky business to open a car dealership, specifically Ferraris. And I'd love to hear a little bit about how he and his business partner got the dealership off its feet, because it wasn't easy. So what do you want to share that's not giving away too much from the book when it comes to that?
Yeah, I think it's important to give a little background about Ferrari dealerships back in the 1970s. Yes. Most of the other dealerships, especially probably in the early 70s, any Ferrari dealership in North America at that time was really owned by someone who was successful with other models of cars. So they had Chevrolet dealerships, Ford dealerships, BMW dealerships, whatever, that had been in business for a long time and they'd made money. And so they didn't really need the Ferrari dealership. They really probably took it as a status symbol, and it's kind of cool to have the prancing horse on the building next door.
Right.
And I'm sure the owner of the dealership, he got the demo car and he could drive a Ferrari home every night and all that. And so what you had was a group of 30 or 40 dealers across the United States that I would say most of them probably didn't care whether they sold a Ferrari or not. that wasn't what paid their bills. Their lot where the average person was buying a Chevy or a Ford, that's where their volume was, and that's where they were making their money. So that's the kind of the background. Brian and Richard, his partner, Richard Revor, were in their early 30s. They were both trying to get a Ferrari dealership, and then they became friends and decided to try to, strengthen numbers. So maybe the two of us, we can talk. At the time, it was Bill Hara at Modern Classic Motors in Nevada that was the West Coast distributor for Ferrari. So he chose who the dealers were. The cars came through him, and so they had to convince they weren't talking directly with Bill, but they were talking with his general manager, Vern Kyle, at the time. And, Vern kept telling him, you guys, you don't understand. These dealerships are not for young guys. You're not going to make a lot of money. You're not going to sell very many cars. These guys that have the dealerships, they're successful because of something else, not because of Ferrari. So everybody had this mindset of it's not a big deal, right? In the early 70s, a few years before Brian opened the dealership, Ferrari hadn't even sold 100 cars in America. I mean, it's crazy to think about it when you look at nowadays, the thousands and thousands that have been purchased. But it was a very small part of Ferrari's business back then. I think the difference when they finally did, and I won't go into all the details, like you said, there's in the book, but that when they did get the dealership, which was a long drawn out process, I think that the difference was they had to sell Ferraris or they couldn't pay their rent. Where all the other guys, they didn't care whether they sold a Ferrari or not. So they started out, they were a couple guys who they were very, very optimistic. I think they both had the attitude of, we can do anything if we set our minds to it. And they had a lot of, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, guts and grit. They were going to make it work no matter what. And they did. They bought all, I think Harris had about 19 cars in their warehouse, new Ferraris. It's an interesting part of the book that I liked when they went to look at the cars and they were looking around and they realized that none of them were red. And so, wait a minute, we're going to open a Ferrari dealership and we're going to have, yellow cars and green cars and black cars, no red Ferraris.
No Ferrari red. Yeah.
Yeah. But it didn't, I think they probably were a little bit taken aback at the beginning, but then they thought about it and they said, hey man, we've got a dealership and we're going to have Ferraris to sell. Who cares what color they are? And so again, that's the attitude they took. They sold all of those cars in less than a couple months. I was very successful. They were profitable within 30 or 45 days of starting the business, which is kind of unheard of, especially back then. Even high-tech companies would go for years without making any money. So they were fairly successful at the very beginning. And then they figured out ways when Ferrari said, hey, we don't have any cars left to send. We haven't had orders like this for a long time. It's going to take a few months. They got up one morning and said, look, we got to get more cars. Where are we going to get them? And one of them had the idea of call the other dealers. So they did. They called all the dealers across the United States and said, we'll buy any car you have. Dealers were saying stuff like, well, I got a couple here. They've been here a long time. Nobody wants them. They're not, it's a white one. Nobody wants a white one. Brian would say, send it west. I'll sell it. Mm-hmm. And they sold it. He told me he came up with the line because everybody said, I want a red one. And he taught his salespeople. He said, you got to say to them, why would you want the color that everybody else has? So then it made people start thinking, oh yeah, okay, well, and then when you sold one or two and it worked. So he had to come up with a reason. And he always found a reason to keep growing the business.
I'm so glad you mentioned the why would you want one if, out of the same color that everybody else has, because that's one of my favorite parts of the book when I read that. That was fantastic. Yeah. And such a great angle to take on it. Now, you do mention some other strategies they took, which I think may have helped sort of make them successful. A simple one is just the idea that they wore polo shirts and, you know, kind of had a casual, friendly look instead of being like a stuffy, elegant, rich, you know, expensive car dealership. Is there anything else that Brian and his partners may have done to help them succeed?
Sure. I think that was a big deal back then. And even for many years after they started the dealership, if you walked onto a car lot, usually the guy had a suit and tie on, or at least if it was a warm day, he had a tie and a white shirt on. And, you know, I think Brian told me one of the customers mentioned something to him about it, that they felt intimidated to come into a Ferrari lot, you know, and some of the other Ferrari dealerships, to be honest, if you didn't look like you were a wealthy person, they didn't really want you on the Ferrari lot. They wanted you over on the other lot where they were making money. They almost had an attitude of, well, and they did, if you don't have cash, you can't buy a car here. And so Brian did a number of things. The first thing was, guys, we aren't wearing suits and ties anymore. Everybody's going to wear a polo shirt and jeans. I want you all to look like our customers. I want our customers to feel comfortable. He said, I found out that it's easier to sell something to somebody that feels comfortable and not stressed out and, you know, not intimidated. And so that's what we're going to do. But he also, his goal was that the average person off the street could own a Ferrari. And like I said, most of the other dealers didn't see it that way. And so he decided, I'll take trade-ins. If you don't have cash, it doesn't matter. You have a trade-in. He got some really cool classic cars, hot rods, muscle cars, all kinds of things being traded in on Ferraris. And he also came up with a banker friend that he had. Again, this was probably late 70s or early 80s. They put together a financing program. So you could come in and you could have a payment, a monthly payment that was no different than a Ford or Chevy, but you just had a huge balloon payment at the end of 3 years. And but the cars were going up in value. The banks were really willing to refinance. So in a way, it was almost like the way we lease cars today. But there were no leases back in the early 1980s. It was a concept that didn't even exist. So he was a pioneer. He was doing things different. Yeah. I've always felt the businesses that really succeed are the ones that did something different.
And did Los Gatos, did the location help at all? Because one of the things I'm curious about is, you know, you always hear location, location, location. So did Los Gatos have anything specific to it that kind of made it a perfect place to have a Ferrari dealership?
I think being in Silicon Valley, where a lot of things were going on and a lot of people were becoming wealthy, helped. But to be honest with you, he had customers that came all the way from Europe when they heard about this dealership that had all these cars. There's a Monterey Car Week that's still very popular near Carmel in Monterey every year, Pebble Beach and in that area. Mm-hmm. And back in the 1980s, people were coming from all over the globe to go to that. They still are. They estimated about 100,000 people used to come for that car week back in the 1980s. It was interesting that you couldn't get to Monterey from San Francisco Airport or San Jose Airport without driving through Los Gatos. There was another way to go, but it was out of the way and nobody went that way. So here you've got all these people coming from all over the world to see these cool cars. And if you the days at the beginning of Monterey Car Week, the Ferrari of Los Gatos lot always had 40 or 50 of these people that were heading to the show, but they wanted to see what was at Ferrari of Los Gatos first. Sometimes some of those cars ended up at the show or were at the show, but people started talking about it. They started sharing stories with others, and it literally got to the point where even people in Europe were familiar with Ferrari and Los Gatos. He told me this, Brian told me the story that one of his customers one time had gone to Europe for vacation, had been in Paris, and when they were sitting in one of the outside cafes, they started talking with some of the Parisians that were there and that could speak English. And they told him, they asked him where they were from, and they said, "We're from Los Gatos, California." And they said, they said, "Oh, Los Gatos, isn't that the city with all the Ferraris?" So this was just crazy that it could have that far of a reach. But, you know, and it's a bit of a coincidence that they ran into somebody who knew that. I'm sure it wasn't mm-hmm. the average Parisian on the street, but it just shows you that it's word of mouth. It's a number of things that happened. There's stories in the book about things that happened that got him a lot of publicity. You know, the one guy that smashed up his Lamborghini across the street and it was on the national news. And Brian said, boy, after that, people were coming from everywhere. They wanted to see what was going on at our dealership. But I think that, plus the fact that he didn't have just Ferraris and he didn't have just new Ferraris. He had used Ferraris. He had, like I said, muscle cars, classic cars. It could find you almost any car you wanted. If you were a car enthusiast and you had your mind set on a car, he got a reputation of, if Ferrari of Los Gatos can't find it for you, probably nobody can find it for you. So
right. And I believe it. And the book is full of these, other crazy, interesting characters and tales. And you already mentioned Bill Hara, who I know he wasn't directly involved, but still the idea that he was the distributor for Ferrari at the time is fascinating to me. But there's also sort of run-ins with potential drug dealers or criminals, and there's a chase, and there's all these things happen. What are some of your favorite stories that you're willing to share, or even is there one that may not have been in the book?
I like the story about the drug dealers that bought a car and wanted to pay cash, and he had to deliver it by a certain time, and they wouldn't give him an address, and they wouldn't even write a map of how to get to the place. It was up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, which back at that time, there was a lot of drug stuff going on up there. That's kind of what was happening in the 1980s. So that's a fun story. But I think, honestly, reflecting back on the book now, I might enjoy the epilogue at the end of the book the most, because it tells a story about how, you know, I mentioned at the beginning, this was the rise and fall. I mean, I don't want to do a spoiler alert here, but the business didn't succeed at the end. It became the most successful, and then he ended up losing everything. But so there's a great story about how that all happened, which I won't go into. But when the dealership got stripped away from him and he kind of lost that and everything else, he never lost his passion for the cars and his just passion for what he was doing. And to this day, I mean, it's now close to 30 years probably since he lost the dealership. He's still doing the same thing he was doing before. He's not doing it with his own dealership, but he's helping friends that have dealerships, and he's still on the phone. It's amazing when I'm with him sometimes, his phone's constantly ringing, and it's somebody looking for a specific kind of car. I wrote a little bit at the end of the book about, I was there at that dealership where he's helping a friend currently, and it's kind of a classic car. It's got old cars on it, classic car dealership. And there was a young kid there, probably one of the lot kids, that he was trying to start an old car. It was a car from the 1920s or 1930s, and he couldn't get it to start. And I saw Brian looking over at him, and he finally yelled at him, and he said, "Hey, pull the choke all the way out, put the gas pedal to the floor, and it'll start up. But then take your foot off the gas pedal he said, don't use the choke anymore. Just use the gas pedal to keep it running." And it all happened in like 5 seconds. It started up. It ran beautiful. And his kid had been trying for 5 or 10 minutes to get it started. And I thought, see, this is what's still alive in Brian. he used to tell me he could tell when a car drove up that needed to go in for servicing, he could tell what was wrong with the car most of the time before, just when the car drove in, by the sounds it was making. He really mm-hmm. knows a lot about cars. He probably knows more than most people. And he never lost that. And I thought that was pretty cool, that even though you could go through some tough times in your life and lose things that were important to you, you know, there's some things we never lose, no matter what. But there's a lot of stories in there I could say are my favorites. Yeah.
It makes sense. Do you have any plans to do any more writing now that you've dipped your toes into this world?
Yeah, I do, and I did, and they kind of got put on hold a little bit here. I like to write stories, you know, just like the story I wrote about Brian. Find somebody who has a remarkable story that other people might like to hear about, and then, you know, spend time with that person. And I, with Brian, and the way I would do it again is I recorded him. We spent many, many hours together, and I just recorded. I said, I would say stuff like, you talk about anything you want. Tell me something that was interesting about the dealership. And then I just strung it all together, you know, later on. Mm-hmm. I listened. I had the recordings transcribed, and I read them, and I listened to them. And anyhow, that's kind of the way I did it. So I met an individual down in Southern California that was involved in Muscle Beach when it first started. There were two Muscle Beach. Most people, when you say Muscle Beach, immediately they go to Arnold Schwarzenegger, and that's the new Muscle Beach. But there was one before that, and it was back probably in the 1940s, maybe even started in the late 30s. And it was mainly, you know, movie stars and famous people that were there. But there were, on the weekends, there were thousands of people that would go to Muscle Beach to watch these guys perform. There was weightlifting and physical training and everything, but they were also acrobats. They did a lot of acrobatic things. So anyhow, long story short, he had an incredible story that he told me. So I thought, you know, this is kind of like Brian again. It's not cars, but it's Muscle Beach. And so I started working with him a couple of years ago on that. And I got probably half of the book written already, but what happened is I had retired, and that's what I was going to do. I was going to write books, and a good friend of mine that I had been in business with about 20 years ago called me last October and told me about a company that he'd had in research and development for about 10 or 12 years, and now he was ready to commercialize it and go to market, and it's a very cool thing. It's a he's found a way to filter a blood draw and have early detection of cancer for even back to stage zero. So it's something that's, you know, it can change a lot of lives. And I decided, okay, I'll go back into the workforce. And so the last 4 to 5 months, that's what I've been concentrating on. But someday, I would like to get back to writing. To tell you the truth, even this friend that I'm working with now, he's got an incredible story of what happened for him to do this. That's probably another book. So, yes, there will be more books, God willing, and the river don't rise. You know, if I'm around for long enough, I'll write some more books.
Well, you did a great job, so I hope you do. It was a fascinating book. It was honestly just such a delight to read. It read really fast, which I always take as a good sign as a good book. When I get through it, I'm like, oh, I'm done already. And where can people find it? Where do you suggest people go to look for The Dealer?
Yeah, there's it's available in many bookstores. Some of the bookstores don't carry it on the shelf. You have to order it, but it's on Amazon. That's the easiest place to find it and buy it. I also have a website, which you can buy the book on the website. You can also read a lot more about things that maybe aren't in the book, or some of the stories of how I got the book published. I had a blog called flgstory.com that is still available for people to go look at and read articles. My website is just my name, jimchardella.com. People can look at it. I mean, you can look up, just Google The Dealer
dealer. And, yeah.
It'll guide you in the right direction.
Right. And I'll put some links in our show notes for everybody listening. I'll have all the links that Jim just mentioned to make it easy for you.
That's awesome. And
yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jim. I really enjoyed this. I loved learning more about this book, and I'm glad that you're still interested in writing.
Yeah, I know. I really appreciate the comments. I hear it all the time, and that's really what my goal was. You know, I have a lot of books that I read 20 or 30 pages and stopped, and they're sitting on the shelf behind me. Probably 80% of those books are in that category. But I've had many, many people say exactly what you just said. It's an easy read. I've had people say it. I picked it up and I couldn't stop reading it. I had somebody two nights ago. I was at a club dinner, and a gentleman came up to me and said, I'm reading your book right now, and I'm really enjoying it. And he said, but you know what? He said, I'm slowing down. I'm getting towards the end of the book, and I'm reading it slower and slower. And the reason is I don't want the story to end.
And I thought, that's great.
Oh, my goodness. This is like an author's dream come true, right?
Absolutely. So, that's the best compliment you can get.
Here I am, a guy who didn't know what he was doing and never wrote a book before, and now I'm getting comments like that. So it gives me chills thinking about it. But anyhow, I really appreciate being on the show with you, and I hope to talk to you more about maybe a future book.
Oh, I would love it. I would love it. Well, thank you so much, Jim. You have a good rest of your day.
Okay, Michael.
Thank you for listening to Fuel for the Future, presented by State Farm Insurance and driven by America's Automotive Trust. To learn more, visit americasautomotivetrust.org. And to find out where to pick up a copy of The Dealer, see our show notes or visit jimchardella.com.